How do you know what crap tastes like? You know, Mr. McCourt, you're a nice guy, but you can be exasperating. You know, Jack, what Ben Johnson said? No, Mr. McCourt, I don't know what Ben Johnson said. He said, language reveals the man, speak that I may see thee. Oh, is that what Ben Johnson said? That's what Ben Johnson said. Pretty clever, Mr. McCourt. He should have dinner with Mimi. On open school day, the kids are dismissed at noon, and the parents come swarming in from 1 to 3, and again in the evening from 7 to 9. At the end of the day, you meet teachers punching out at the time clock, and they're weary from talking to hundreds of parents. There are 3,000 kids in this school, and that should add up to 6,000 parents, but this is New York, where divorce is a major sport and kids have to sort out who's who and what's what and when will it happen. 3,000 kids could have 10,000 parents and step-parents who are certain their sons and daughters are the brightest of the bright. This is Stuyvesant High School, where the minute students step inside, doors swing open to the best universities and colleges in the country, and if you don't succeed, it's your own damn fault. The moms and dads are cool, confident, cheerful, self-assured when they're not worried, concerned, despairing, uncertain, suspicious. They have high expectations and nothing less than success will satisfy them. They turn out in such numbers, every teacher needs a student monitor to manage the flow. They are anxious about their child standing in the class. Would I say Stanley is above average? Because they think he's getting lazy and hanging out with the wrong people. They hear about Stuyvesant Square, things about drugs, you know, and that's enough to make you lose sleep. Is he doing his work? Do you notice any changes in his behavior and attitudes? Stanley's parents are going through a bitter divorce, and no wonder Stanley is screwed up. The mother keeps the classic six-room apartment on the Upper West Side while Dad is in some hovel in the arse end of the Bronx. They've agreed to split Stanley down the middle, 3.5 days every week with each of them. Stanley is good at mathematics, but even he doesn't know how to divide himself like that. He's good-humored about it. He turns his dilemma into some kind of algebraic equation. If A equals 3.5 and B equals 3.5, then what is Stanley? His math teacher, Mr. Winokur, gives Stanley a grade of 100 for even thinking along such lines. In the meantime, my monitor on open school night is Maureen McSherry, and she tells me Stanley's battling father and mother are sitting in my classroom waiting to see me, and Maureen adds, there must be a half a dozen battling couples who won't sit together while I talk about their little darlings. Maureen has given them numbers, like the ones you get in a bakery, and my heart is sinking because there seems to be no end to the flow of parents coming into the room. As soon as you're finished with one, another arrives. They fill all the seats. Three are perched like kids on the back windowsill, whispering, and half a dozen stand along the back wall. I wish I could tell Maureen to call a halt, but you can't in a school like Stuyvesant, where the parents know their rights and are never at a loss for words. Maureen whispers, "Watch out. Here comes Stanley's mother, Rhonda. She'll have you for breakfast." Rhonda reeks of nicotine. She sits and leans towards me and tells me not to believe a word of what that son of a bitch Stanley's father tells me. She can't even bear to say the bastard's name and feels sorry for poor Stanley that he's stuck with this prick for a father figure. And how is Stanley doing anyway? Oh, fine, he's a pretty good writer and popular with the other kids. Well, that's a miracle, considering what he's going through with Jerko Dad running around with every bit of skirt he can pick up. I do my best the times I have Stanley, but he can't concentrate 3.5 days a week, knowing the next 3.5 days he's in that hovel in the Bronx. What's happening is that he's started to stay over at other kids' houses. That's what he tells me. But I happen to know he's got this girlfriend whose parents are completely permissive, and I have my suspicions. I'm afraid I don't know anything about that. I'm just his teacher, and it's impossible to get into the private lives of 175 kids every semester. Rhonda's voice carried, and the waiting parents were shifting in their seats, rolling their eyes, restless. Maureen told me I'd have to watch the clock, give each parent no more than 2 minutes, even Stanley's father, who would demand equal time. He said, "Hi, I'm Ben, Stanley's dad. Look, I heard what she said, the therapist. I wouldn't send a dog to her." He laughed and shook his head. "But let's not get into that. I got this problem with Stanley now. After all this education, after me saving for his college education for years, he wants to screw the whole thing up. You know what he wants to do? Go to some conservatory in New England and study classical guitar. Tell me, what kind of money is there in playing classical guitar?" I told him, "But look, I won't take up your time, Mr. McCord." "McCord? Yeah, I won't take up your time," but I told him, "over my dead body." We agreed from day one he'd be an accountant. Never any doubt about that. I mean, what am I working for? I'm a CPA myself, and if you have any little problems, I'd be glad to help out. "No, sir, no classical guitar." I tell him, "Go get your accountancy degree and play your guitar in your own spare time." He breaks down, he cries, he threatens to live with his mother, and I wouldn't wish that on a Nazi. So, I wonder if you could have a word with him. I know he likes your class, likes playing recipes or whatever you're doing here. "I'd like to help, but I'm not a guidance counselor, I'm an English teacher." "Oh yeah? Well, from what Stanley tells me about this class, the last thing you do here is teach English. No offense, but I don't know what cooking has to do with English. Thanks anyway, and how's he doing?" "He's doing well." The bell rings, and Maureen, who is not shy, announces that time is up, but she'd be glad to take names and phone numbers of anyone who'd like to come in for a 15-minute conference on school days. She passes around a sheet of paper, which remains blank. "They want my attention here and now. Christ! They've waited half the night, while these other loonies babbled on about their messed-up kids. And no wonder they're a mess, the parents they have." The frustrated ones follow me down the hall, asking, "How is Adam doing? Sergei, Juan, Naomi? What kind of school is this where you can't get the attention of a teacher for a minute? And what am I paying taxes for?" At 9, teachers punching out at the time clock are talking about going around the corner for a drink at the gas house. We sit at a table in the back and order pitchers of beer. We're dry from talk, talk, talk. Jesus, what a night. I tell Arlene Dahlberg and Connie Collier and Bill Toohey that in all my years of Stuyvesant, only one parent, a mother, asked if her son was enjoying school. I said yes, he seemed to be enjoying himself. She smiled, stood up and said, "Thank you," and left. One parent in all those years. "All they care about is success and money, money, money," says Connie. "They have expectations for their kids, high hopes. And we're like workers on an assembly line, sticking a little part in here, another little part in there, till the finished product comes out at the end, all ready to perform for parent and corporation." A group of parents wandered into the gas house. One came over to me. "This is nice," she said. "You have time to guzzle beer, but you can't spare a minute for a parent who waited half an hour to see you." I told her I was sorry. She said, "Yeah," and joined her group at another table. I felt so weighed down by that evening of parents who drank too much and stayed in bed next morning. Why didn't I just tell that mother to kiss my royal Irish arse? In my class, Bob Stein never sat at a desk. Could have been his bulk, but I think he found comfort perched on the deep, capacious windowsill in the back of the room. As soon as he was settled, he smiled and waved. "Good morning, Mr. McCord. Isn't this a great day?" Through all the seasons of the school year, he wore a white shirt open at the neck, the white collar lapped over the grey collar of his double-breasted jacket. He told the class that the jacket once belonged to Orson Welles, and if he ever met Welles, they'd have something to talk about. If it weren't for that jacket, he wouldn't know what to say to Orson Welles, as his interests were completely different from the actor's. He wore short pants that were long pants cut off at the knees, and no, they did not match the jacket, so there was no connection with Orson Welles. He wore grey socks so heavy They lumped in woolen piles over his yellow construction boots. He carried no bag, no books, no notebooks, no pen. He joked that it was partly my fault because of the excited way I once talked about Thoreau and how you should simplify, 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 and get rid of possessions. When there was a written assignment or a test in class, he asked me if by any chance he could borrow a pen and some paper. "Bob, this is a writing class. It requires certain materials." He assured me everything would be all right and advised me not to worry. He told me from the windowsill the snow was appearing on my head and I should enjoy the years left to me. "No, no," he told the class, "don't laugh." But they were already in hysterics and so loud I had to wait to hear him again. He said that in a year from now, I just look back at this moment and wonder why I wasted my time and emotions on his lack of pen and paper. I had to play the part of stern teacher. "Bob, you could fail this class if you don't participate." "Mr. McCourt, I can't believe you're telling me this. You of all people with your miserable childhood and everything, Mr. McCourt. But it's okay. If you fail me, I'll take the course again. No big hurry. What's a year or two one way or the other? For you, maybe it's a big thing. But I'm only 17. All the time in the world, Mr. McCourt, even if you fail me." He asked the class if anyone would like to help him out with pen and paper. There were 10 offers, but he took the one closest so that he wouldn't have to climb down from his windowsill. He said, "See, Mr. McCourt, see how nice people are? Long as they carry these big bags, you and I will never have to worry about supplies." "Yes, yes, Bob, but how is that going to help you next week when we have the big test on Gilgamesh?" "What's that, Mr. McCourt?" "It's in the world literature book, Bob." "Oh, yeah, I remember that book, big book. I have it at home, and my dad's reading the Bible parts and all. My dad's a rabbi, you know. He was so happy you gave us that book with all the prophets and everything, and he said you must be a great teacher, and he's coming to see you on open school night. I told him you were a great teacher, except you have this thing about pens and paper." "Cut it out, Bob. You haven't even looked at the book." He urged me again not to worry, as his father, the rabbi, often talked about the book, and he, Bob, would be sure to find out all about Gilgamesh and anything else that would make the teacher happy. Again, the class erupted, embracing one another, high-fiving. I wanted to erupt too, but I had to maintain teacher dignity. Across the room, over the giggling and gasping and laughing, I called, "Bob, Bob, it would make me happy if you read the world literature book yourself and left your poor father in peace." He said he'd love to read the book cover to cover, but it did not fit into his plans. "And what are your plans, Bob?" "I'm going to be a farmer." He smiled and waved the pen and paper so kindly donated by Jonathan Greenberg and said he was sorry for disrupting the class and maybe we should start writing what I wanted them to write at the start of the period, which was quickly passing. He, Bob, was ready and suggested the class quiet down so Mr. McCourt could get on with his work. He told them teaching is the hardest work in the world, and he should know because once in summer camp, he tried to teach a bunch of small kids about things that grow on the ground, but they wouldn't listen to him, just ran around chasing bugs till he got mad and said he kicked their asses, and that was the end of his teaching career. So have a little concern for Mr. McCourt. But before we got down to business, he'd like to explain he had nothing against world literature, except that now he read nothing but publications from the Department of Agriculture and magazines that had to do with farming. He said, "There's more to farming than meets the eye, but that's another subject." And he could see I wanted to get on with my lesson. And what was that lesson, Mr. McCourt? What was I to do with this large boy on the windowsill, a Jewish future farmer of America? Jonathan Greenberg raised his hand and asked what was it about farming that didn't meet the eye. Bob looked gloomy for a moment. "It's my dad," he said. "He's having trouble with the corn and the pigs. He says Jews don't eat corn on the cob. He says you can go up one street and down the other in Williamsburg and Crown Heights and look in Jewish windows at dinner time, and you'll never see anyone chewing on corn on the cob. It just isn't a Jewish thing. Gets in the beard. Show me a Jew eating corn on the cob, and I'll show you one who has lost the faith. That's my dad talking, but the last straw was pigs. I told my dad I like them. I'm not planning to eat them or anything, but I'd like to raise them and sell them to the goyim. What's wrong with that? They're really pleasant little animals, and they can be very affectionate. I told my dad I'd be married and have kids, and they'll like the little piglets. He nearly went crazy, and my mom had to go and lie down. Maybe I shouldn't have told them, but they taught me to tell the truth, and it'll come out in the end anyway. The bell rang. Bob climbed off the windowsill and returned pen and paper to Jonathan. He said his father, the rabbi, would be in to see me on open school night next week, and he was sorry about the disruption. The rabbi sat by my desk, heaved up his hands and said, "Oi." I thought he was joking, but the way he dropped his chin to his chest and shook his head told me this was not a happy rabbi. He said, "Bob, how's he doing?" He had a German accent. "Fine," I said. "He's killing us, breaking our hearts. Did he tell you? He wants to be a farmer." "It's a healthy life, Mr. Stein. It's a scandal. We're not paying for him to go to college so he can raise pigs and corn. Fingers will be pointed on our street. It's going to kill my wife. We told him he wants to go that way. He's going to pay for himself, and that's final. He says, 'Don't worry. Big government programs have scholarships for kids who want to be farmers,' and he knows all about that. House full of books and stuff from Washington and some college in Ohio. So we're losing him, Mr. McCoot. Our son is dead. We can't have a son living with pigs every day." "I'm sorry, Mr. Stein." 6 years later, I met Bob on Lower Broadway. It was a January day, but he was attired as usual in short pants and Orson Welles jacket. He said, "Hi, Mr. McCourt. Great day, isn't it?" "It's freezing, Bob." "Oh, that's okay." He told me he was already working for a farmer in Ohio, but he couldn't go through with the pig thing. That would destroy his parents. I told him that was a good and loving decision. He paused and looked at me. "Mr. McCourt, you never liked me, did you?" "Never liked you, Bob. Are you joking? It was a joy to have you in my classroom. Jonathan said you drove the gloom from the room." "Tell him, McCourt. Tell him the truth. Tell him how he brightened your days. How you told your friends about him, what an original he was, how you admired his style, his good humor, his honesty, his courage, how you would have given your soul for a son like him. And tell him how beautiful he was and is in every way, how you loved him then and love him now. Tell him." I did. And he was speechless, and I didn't give a tinker's damn what people thought on Lower Broadway when they saw us in a long, warm embrace. The high school teacher and the large Jewish future farmer of America. Ken was a Korean boy who hated his father. He told the class how he had to take piano lessons, even though they had no piano. His father made him practice scales on the kitchen table till they could afford a piano, and if his father suspected he wasn't practicing properly, he whacked him across the fingers with a spatula. His six-year-old sister, too. When they got a real piano, and she played chopsticks, he dragged her up the piano stool, into her room, tore a pile of her clothes from drawers, stuffed them into a pillowcase, dragged her down the hallway, so that she could see him throwing her clothes into the incinerator. That would teach her to practice properly. When Ken was in elementary school, he had to join the Boy Scouts and amass merit badges, more than anyone in his troop. Then, in high school, the father insisted he achieve Eagle Scout because that would look good when Ken applied to Harvard. Ken did not want to spend time trying to be an Eagle Scout, but he had no choice. Harvard was on the horizon. Also, he was required by his father to excel in the martial arts, to rise from belt to belt, till he reached black. In everything he obeyed till it came to choice of college. His father told him he was to concentrate on applying to two universities, Harvard and MIT. Even back in Korea, everyone knew that's where you go. Ken said no. He was applying to Stanford in California. He wanted to live on the other side of the continent, as far from his father as possible. His father said no, he would not allow that. Ken said if he didn't go to Stanford, he wasn't going to college at all. The father moved toward him in the kitchen and threatened him. Ken, martial arts expert, said, "Just try it, Dad." And Dad backed off. Dad could have said, "All right, do what you like." But what would his neighbors say? What would they say in his church? Imagine having a son graduating from Stuyvesant High School and refusing to go to college. Dad would be disgraced. His friends were proudly sending their children to Harvard and MIT, and if Ken had any regard for the reputation of his family, he'd forget Stanford. He wrote me from Stanford. He liked the sunshine out there. College life was easier than Stuyvesant High School, less pressure, less competition. He had just had a letter from his mother, who said he was to concentrate on his studies and participate in no extracurricular activities, no sports, no clubs, nothing. And unless he had straight A's in his courses, he was not to come home for Christmas. He said in the letter that would suit him fine. He didn't want to come home for Christmas anyway. He came home only to see his sister. He appeared at my classroom door a few days before Christmas and told me I'd helped him to get through the last year of high school. At one time, he had a dream of going into a dark alleyway with his father, and only one of them would come out. He'd be the one, of course. But out there in Stanford, he began to think about his father and what it was like coming from Korea, working day and night selling fruit and vegetables, when he knew barely enough English to get through the day, hanging on, desperate for his children to get the education he never had in Korea, that you couldn't even dream of in Korea. And then, in an English class at Stanford, when Ken was called on by the professor to talk about a favorite poem, what popped up in his memory was "My Papa's Waltz," and Jesus, it was too much. He broke down and wept in front of all those people. And the professor was terrific, put his arm around Ken's shoulder and led him down the hallway to his office till he could recover. He stayed an hour in the professor's office, talking and crying, the professor saying it was okay. He had a father he thought was a mean son-of-a-bitch Polish Jew, forgetting that that mean son-of-a-bitch survived Auschwitz and made his way to California and raised the professor and two other kids, ran a delicatessen in Santa Barbara, every organ in his body threatening to collapse, undermined in the camp. The professor said their two fathers would have a lot to talk about, but that would never happen. The Korean grocer and the Polish-Jewish delicatessen man could never find the words that come so easily in a university. Ken said a huge weight was lifted in the professor's office. Or you could say all kinds of poison had flowed out of his system. Something like that. Now he was going to buy his father a tie for Christmas, flowers for his mother. Yeah. It was crazy buying her flowers, since they sold them in the store, but there was a big difference between the flowers you bought from the Korean corner grocery and the flowers you bought from a real florist. He kept thinking of one remark of the professor's, that the world should let the Polish-Jewish father and the Korean father sit in the sun with their wives if they were lucky enough to have them. Ken laughed over how excited the professor became. Just let them sit in the goddamn sun. But the world won't let them, because there's nothing more dangerous than letting all farts sit in the sun. They might be thinking. Same thing with kids. Keep them busy, or they might start thinking. I'm learning. The Mick from the lanes of Limerick letting the envy hang out. I'm dealing with first and second generation immigrants like myself. But I've also got the middle classes and the upper middle classes, and I'm sneering. I don't want to sneer, but all habits die hard. It's the resentment, not even anger, just resentment. I shake my head over the things that concern them. That middle class stuff. It's too hot, it's too cold, and this is not the toothpaste I like. Here I am, after 3 decades in America, still happy to be able to turn on the electric light or reach for a towel after the shower. I'm reading a man named Krishnamurti, and what I like about him is that he doesn't hold himself up as a guru like some of his characters who come storming out of India with tin cups that collect millions. He refuses to be guru or wise man or anything else. He tells you, suggests, that in the long run, baby, you're on your own. There's a chilling essay by Thoreau called Walking, where he says, when you go out the door for a walk, you should be so free, so unencumbered, you need never return to the starting place. You just keep walking because you're free. I had the kids read this essay, and they said, oh no, they could never do that. Just walk away. You kidding? Which is strange, because when I talked to them about Kerouac and Ginsberg hitting the road, they thought it was wonderful. All that freedom, marijuana and women and wine for 3,000 miles. When I talk to those kids, I'm talking to myself. What we have in common is urgency. Christ, I'm middle-aged and making discoveries the average intelligent American knew at 20. The mask is mostly off, and I can breathe. The kids are opening up in their writing and classroom discussions, and I'm getting a written tour of American family life from Eastside townhouses to Chinatown tenements. It's a pageant of the settled and the new, and everywhere there are dragons and demons. Phyllis wrote an account of how her family gathered the night Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, how they shuttled between the living room television and the bedroom where her father lay dying, back and forth, concerned with the father, not wanting to miss the moon landing. Phyllis said she was with her father when her mother called to come and see Armstrong set foot on the moon. She ran to the living room, everyone cheering and hugging, till she felt this urgency, the old urgency, and ran to the bedroom to find her father dead. She didn't scream, she didn't cry, and her problem was how to return to the happy people in the living room to tell them Dad was gone. She cried now, standing in front of the classroom. She could have stepped back to her seat in the front row, and I hoped she would, because I didn't know what to do. I went to her. I put my left arm around her, but that wasn't enough. I pulled her to me, embraced her with both arms, let her sob into my shoulder. Faces around the room were wet with tears, and someone called, "Right on, Phyllis!" And one or two clapped, and the whole class clapped and cheered, and Phyllis turned to smile at them with her wet face, and when I led her to her seat, she turned and touched my cheek, and I thought, this isn't earth-shaking, this touch on the cheek, but I'll never forget it. Phyllis, her dead father, Armstrong on the moon. Listen. Are you listening? You're not listening. I'm talking to those of you in this class who might be interested in writing. Every moment of your life, you're writing. Even in your dreams, you're writing. When you walk the halls in this school, you meet various people and you write furiously in your head. There is the principle. You have to make a decision, a greeting decision. Will you nod? Will you smile? Will you say, "Good morning, Mr. Baumel," or will you simply say, "Hi"? You see someone you dislike, furious writing again in your head, decision to be made, turn your head away. Stare as you pass, nod, hiss a hi. You see someone you like and you say, "Hi," in a warm, melting way. A hi that conjures up splash of oars, soaring violins, eyes shining in the moonlight. There are so many ways of saying hi. Hiss it, trill it, bark it, sing it, bellow it, laugh it, cough it. A simple stroll in the hallway calls for paragraphs, sentences in your head, decisions galore. I'll do this as a male because women for me still remain the great mystery. I could tell you stories. Are you listening? There's a girl in the school you've fallen in love with. You happen to know she's broken up with someone else, so the field is clear. You'd like to go out with her. Oh, the writing now scissors in your head. You might be one of those cool characters who could saunter up to Helen of Troy and ask her what she's doing after the siege, that you know a nice Lam and Uzo place in the ruins of Ilium. The cool character, the charmer, doesn't have to prepare much of a script. The rest of us are writing. You call to see if she'll go out with you on Saturday night. You're nervous. Rejection will lead you to the edge of the cliff, the overdose. You tell her on the phone. You're in her physics class. She says doubtfully, "Oh, yeah?" You ask if she's busy Saturday night. She's not busy. She has nothing planned, but you suspect she's lying. A girl cannot admit she has nothing to do on Saturday night. It would be un-American. She has to put on the act. God, what would the world say? You, writing in your head, ask about the following Saturday night and all the other Saturdays stretching into infinity. You'll settle for anything, you poor little schmuck. Anything, as long as you can see her before you start collecting Social Security. She plays her little game. Tells you, call her again next week, and she'll see. Yeah, she'll see. She sits at home on Saturday night watching TV with her mother and Aunt Edna, who never shuts up. You sit home Saturday night with your mother and father, who never say anything. You go to bed and dream that next week, oh God, next week, she might say yes. And if she does, you have it all planned. That cute little Italian restaurant on Columbus Avenue with the red and white checked tablecloth and the Chianti bottles holding those dripping white candles. Dreaming, wishing, planning, it's all writing. But the difference between you and the man in the street is that you are looking at it, friends, getting it set in your head, realizing the significance of the insignificant, getting it on paper. You might be in the throes of love or grief, but you are ruthless in observation. You are your material. You are writers. And one thing is certain. No matter what happens on Saturday night, or any other night, you'll never be bored again. Never. Nothing human is alien to you. Hold your applause and pass up your homework. Mr. McCall, you're lucky. You had that miserable childhood, so you have something to write about. What are we going to write about? All we do is get born, go to school, go on vacation, go to college, fall in love or something, graduate and go into some kind of profession, get married, have the 2.3 kids you're always talking about, send the kids to school, get divorced like 50% of the population, get fat, get the first heart attack, retire, die. Jonathan. That is the most miserable scenario of American life I've heard in a high school classroom. But you've supplied the ingredients for the great American novel. You've encapsulated the novels of Theodore Dreiser, Sinclair Lewis, F. Scott Fitzgerald. They said, I must be joking. I said, you know the ingredients of the McCourt life. You have your ingredients too, what you'll use if you write about your life. List your ingredients in your notebook. Cherish them. This is urgent. Jewish. Middle class. New York Times. Classical music on radio. Harvard on the horizon. Chinese, Korean, Italian, Spanish. A foreign language newspaper on the kitchen table. Ethnic music pouring out of the radio. Parents dream of trips to the old country. Grandmother sitting silent in a corner of the living room. Remembers glimpses of cemeteries in Queens, thousands of headstones and crosses, begs, please, please don't put me there, take me to China, please. So, sit with your grandmother, let her tell her story. All the grandmothers and grandfathers have stories, and if you let them die without taking down their stories, you are criminal. Your punishment is banishment from the school cafeteria. Yeah, ha ha. Parents and grandparents are suspicious of this sudden interest in their lives. Why are you asking me so many questions? My life is nobody's business, and what I did, I did. What did you do? Nobody's business. Is it that teacher again sticking his nose in?
No, Grandma. I just thought you'd want to tell me about your life so I can tell my kids and they can tell their kids and you won't be forgotten.
You tell that teacher mind his own business. All these Americans the same, always asking questions. We got privacy in this family.
But Grandma, this teacher is Irish.
Oh yeah, well, they're the worst, always talking and singing about green things or getting shot and hung.
Others come in with stories of how they asked the elders one question about the past and the dam burst, and the old people won't stop talking, going on till bedtime and beyond, expressing heartache and tears, yearning for the old country, declaring love for America. Family relationships are rearranged. Grandpa isn't taken for granted by 16-year-old Milton anymore. In World War II, Grandpa had adventures you wouldn't believe. Like, he fell in love with the daughter of an SS officer and nearly got killed for it. Grandpa escaped and had to hide in the what-do-you-call-it of a cow in a garbage dump. The hide? Yeah, the only reason the hide was there that it was already half-eaten by rats and he had to fight them off. 3 days in the hide, fighting off the rats, till a Catholic priest saw him and hid him under his church till the Americans came a year later. All these years, Grandpa sits in the corner, and I never talk to him, and he never talked to me. His English still isn't good, but that's no excuse. Now I have him on my tape recorder, my parents, for Christ's sake, are saying, why bother?
Clarence was black, bright, and diffident. He sat in the back of the room with three other black kids, and never contributed to a class discussion. He and his friends had secret jokes, and that annoyed me, that black cabal. At the same time, I thought, if I were black, that's just where I'd be, in the back in a little ghetto of my own, mocking white teacher behind my hand. David was black, bright, and not a bit diffident. He sat over by the great windows with his white friends who followed him in and out of the classroom. When I asked the class a question, his hand would go up, and if he gave the wrong answer, he'd shake his head in exasperation and say, "Oh, spit!" They tried to imitate him, but no one could say, "Oh, spit!" like David. No one could create merriment like David. Students changed their programs just to be in a class with him. When he read his stories and essays on Fridays, they howled. Last Monday morning, I got out of bed, or didn't get out of bed. I only dreamed I was getting out of bed, and I couldn't swear to you now that I was in or out of bed or dreaming about it, or could I be dreaming about it. This is all Mr. Lipper's fault because he was going on in the philosophy class about the Chinese thing where a man dreams about being a butterfly, or was it a butterfly dreaming about being a man, or a butterfly. Oh, spit. Everyone laughed, but not Clarence. His three friends laughed, though they looked a bit sheepish. I asked him if he'd like to read today. He shook his head. I told him this was a writing class where everyone was expected to contribute. And if he was reluctant to read himself, maybe someone else would read what he had written. His indifference irritated me. I wanted one big happy class of David saying, "Oh, spit." That day I had cafeteria patrol. Clarence sat against the wall with a group of black kids. They were laughing at his impersonation of Hitler, a hot dog clasped between lip and nose as a moustache, a ball in his head, a salute, and a Sieg Heil with raised arm. The cafeteria Clarence was not the classroom Clarence. David watched from another table, quiet, unsmiling. After lunch, I asked Clarence if he'd read someday. No, he had nothing to say.
Nothing?
Well, I could never be like David.
You don't have to be like David.
You wouldn't like it. The only stories I know are street stories. Things happen on my street.
So, write something about your street.
Can't. Bad language and all that.
Clarence, tell me one word you know that I haven't heard. One word, Clarence.
But I thought we were to use proper English.
Use any English you like as long as you get it on paper.
The following Friday he was ready. Other readers stood when they read, but he wanted to sit. He reminded me there would be street language, and did I mind? I said, "Nothing human is alien to me," and then I told him I couldn't remember what Russian writer I was quoting. He said, "Oh," and started his account of how the mothers on his street dealt with a drug dealer. They warned him to get off the street, but he told them he had to make a living, and they should go to hell. Six mothers grabbed him one night and took him to a vacant lot. What they did to him there, Clarence couldn't say, but there were rumors. He couldn't repeat the rumors, even if he was allowed, and the language would be too raw for Stuyvesant students. All he could say was that one of the mothers called the ambulance so the guy wouldn't die in the vacant lot. Cops came around, of course, but nobody knew anything, and the cops understood. That's the way it was in Clarence's street. Silence. Wow. Wild cheers. Applause. Clarence sat back in the chair and looked at David, whose clapping was the most enthusiastic of all. David didn't say, "Oh, spit." He knew this was Clarence's moment. They wanted to know, who was that weird guy at the classroom door? He was chalk-white, cadaverous, and stoned. He could have called me Frank, but "Good afternoon," Mr. McCourt showed his respect for the teacher. I stepped into the hallway for one of our brief occasional conferences, where he explained he happened to be in this neighborhood and was thinking about me and wondering how I was doing. Also, he happened to be caught short for the necessities and wondered if I might have any spare change about me. He appreciated past kindnesses, and even though he saw little possibility of repayment, he would always remember me warmly. It was such a pleasure to visit me here and to see the youth of America, these beautiful children, in such capable and generous hands. He said thanks, and he might see me soon at Montero's Bar in Brooklyn, a few blocks from his apartment. In a few minutes, the $10 I slipped him would be passed to a Stuyvesant Square drug dealer. "That's hunky," I told him. "Pick up any history of recent American writing or the Beat Generation, and in the index you'll find Hunky, Herbert. Alcohol is not his habit, but he'll kindly allow you to buy him a drink at Montero's. His voice is deep, gentle, and musical. He never forgets his manners, and you rarely think of him as Hunky the Junkie. He respects law and obeys none of it. He's done jail time for pickpocketing, robbery, possession of drugs, selling drugs. He's a hustler, a con man, a male prostitute, a charmer, a writer. He's given credit for coining the term Beat Generation. He uses people till he exhausts their patience and money, and they tell him, 'Enough, Hunky. Out. Out already.' He understands and never carries grudges. It's all the same to him. I know he's using me, but he knew everyone in the Beat movement. And I like listening to him talk about Burroughs, Corso, Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg. Arlene Dahlberg told me that Ginsberg once compared Hunky to St. Francis of Assisi. Yes, he's a criminal, an outlaw, but he steals only to sustain his drug habit and makes no profit out of his activities. Also, he's sensitive about what he takes. He'll never take a piece of jewelry that looks like an heirloom. He knows if he leaves one thing a victim cherishes, it will generate all kinds of goodwill and ease the pain of losing the other stuff. That will also bring him good luck. He confesses to every crime but murder, even tried suicide in Arlene's house in Mallorca. Giving him the occasional $10 brings a kind of guarantee he won't break into my apartment, though he tells me he's a bit over the hill for second-story work these days and usually has to hire a helper if he hears of good pickings. There's no shortage of willing boys on the Lower East Side. No more climbing fire escapes and rain pipes for Herbert Hunky. There are other ways of penetrating the fastnesses of the affluent, he says. Such as? You won't believe how many queer doormen and maintenance workers there are on Park and Fifth. If I made the right deals, arrangements for this body to meet that body, they'd wave me in and I could practically take a nap in some of those apartments. In the old days, when I was young, I'd peddle myself, and I did very nicely, thank you. I was surprised once by this big insurance executive and ready to face a year in jail, but He called down the hall to his wife, who brought martinis, and we all wound up in the bed in a beautiful menage. Oh, those were the days. We weren't gay then, just queer. Next day, there's a protest note on my desk signed, a mother. She doesn't want to give her name, lest I hold this against her daughter, who came home and told the family about this despicable character, Honky, who is, from what her daughter told her, hardly a figure to inspire the youth of America. She realizes, does the mother, that this person exists on the fringes of American society, and couldn't I find more worthwhile figures to hold up as examples of the good and the true? People like Eleanor Glynn or John P. Marquand? I can't respond to this note. Can't even mention it in class for fear of embarrassing the daughter. I understand the mother's fears, but if this is a class in writing with a nod to literature, what are the limits for the teacher? If a boy or girl writes a story about sex, should I allow it to be read in class? After years with thousands of teenagers listening to them and reading their work, I know their parents have an exaggerated idea of their innocence. The thousands have been my tutors. Without mentioning Hunky, I circle the subject. Look at the lives of Marlowe, Nash, Swift, Villon, Baudelaire, Rimbaud, not to mention those disgraceful characters Byron and Shelley, down to Hemingway's loose ways with women and wine, and Faulkner drinking himself to death down there in Oxford, Mississippi. You might think about Anne Sexton killing herself, Sylvia Plath likewise, and John Berryman jumping off a bridge. Oh, aren't I the connoisseur of the dark? For Christ's sake, McCourt, stop bothering the kids. Back off, leave them alone and they will come home. And if their tails are not wagging, it's due to the numbing effect of an English teacher's blather. Serious students raise their hands and ask how I'll evaluate them for the report cards. After all, I don't give them the usual tests, no multiple choice, no matching columns, no fill-in-the-blank spaces, no true or false. Concerned parents are asking questions. I tell the serious students, evaluate yourselves. What? How can we evaluate ourselves? You do it all the time. We all do it. Constant process of self-evaluation. Examination of conscience, boys and girls. You say to yourself honestly, did I learn anything from reading recipes as poetry, discussing Little Bo Peep as if it were a verse from T.S. Eliot, getting inside my papa's walls, listening to James and Daniel telling the inside story of their dinner, feasting at Stuyvesant Square, reading Mimi Sheridan? I say to you, if you learn nothing from the above, it means you were asleep during the tremendous violin playing of Michael and Pam's epic Ode to Duck. Or, and this is possible, friends, I am a lousy teacher. They cheer, yeah, that's it, you're a lousy teacher. And we all laugh because it's partly true and because they're free to say it because I can take the joke. Serious students are not satisfied. They argue that in other classes the teacher tells you what you're supposed to know. The teacher teaches it and you're supposed to learn it. Then the teacher gives you an examination and you get the grade you deserve. Serious students say it's satisfying when you know in advance what you're supposed to know, so you can set about knowing it. They say, in this class, you never know what you're supposed to know, so how can you study, and how can you possibly evaluate yourself? In this class, you never know what's going to pop up from day to day. The big puzzle at the end of the term is, how does the teacher arrive at a grade? I'll tell you how I arrive at a grade. First, how was your attendance? Even if you sat quietly in the back and thought about the discussions and the readings, you surely learned something. Second, did you participate? Did you get up there and read on Fridays? Anything, stories, essays, poetry, plays. Third, did you comment on the work of your classmates? Fourth, and this is up to you, can you reflect on this experience and ask yourself what you learned? Fifth, did you just sit there and dream? If you did, give yourself credit. This is where the teacher turns serious and asks the big question. What is education anyway? What are we doing in the school? You can say you're trying to graduate so you can go to college and prepare for a career. But, fellow students, it's more than that. I've had to ask myself what the hell I'm doing in the classroom. I've worked out an equation for myself. On the left side of the blackboard, I print a capital F. On the right side, another capital F. I draw an arrow from left to right, from fear to freedom. I don't think anyone achieves complete freedom, but what I am trying to do with you is drive fear into a corner. Time's winged chariot is hurrying near, followed closely by the hound of heaven. You're getting older, and aren't you a two-faced blathering mick prodding and encouraging kids to write when you know your own writer dream is dying? Console yourself with this. One day, one of your gifted students will win a National Book Award or a Pulitzer and invite you to the event and, in a brilliant acceptance speech, allow, as how he or she owes it all to you, you'll be asked to stand. You'll acknowledge the cheers of the multitudes. This will be your moment in the sun, your reward for thousands of lessons taught, millions of words read. Your prize winner embraces you, and you fade into the streets of New York, little old Mr. Chips, toiling the stairs of his tenement, a crust in the cupboard, a jorum of water in the icebox, a bulb of modest wattage dangling over the celibate cot. The great American drama is the clash of adolescence with middle age. My hormones beg for a quiet clearing in the woods. Theirs are brassy, throbbing, demanding. Today, they do not want to be bothered by teachers or parents. Nor do I want to be bothered by them. I don't want to see or hear them. I've squandered my best years in the company of squawking adolescents. In the time I've spent in classrooms, I could have read thousands of books. I could have roamed the 42nd Street Library up one side and down the other. I wish the kids would disappear. I'm not in the mood. Other days, I'm desperate to get into the classroom. I wait, impatient, in the hallway. I paw the ground. Come on, Mr. Ritterman, hurry up, finish your damn math lesson. There are things I want to say to this class. A young substitute teacher sat beside me in the teacher's cafeteria. She was to start her regular teaching career in September, and could I offer her any advice? Find what you love. And do it. That's what it boils down to. I admit I didn't always love teaching. I was out of my depth. You're on your own in the classroom. One man or woman facing five classes every day, five classes of teenagers, one unit of energy against 175 units of energy, 175 ticking bombs, and you have to find ways of saving your own life. They may like you, they may even love you, but they are young, and it is the business of the young to push the old off the planet. I know I'm exaggerating, but it's like a boxer going into the ring or a bullfighter into the arena. You can be knocked out or gored, and that's the end of your teaching career. But if you hang on, you learn the tricks. It's hard, but you have to make yourself comfortable in the classroom. You have to be selfish. The airlines tell you if oxygen fails, you are to put on your mask first, even if your instinct is to save the child. The classroom is a place of high drama. You'll never know what you've done to or for the hundreds coming and going. You see them leaving the classroom, dreamy, flat, sneering, admiring, smiling, puzzled. After a few years, you develop antennae. You can tell when you've reached them or alienate them. It's chemistry, it's psychology, it's animal instinct. You are with the kids, and as long as you want to be a teacher, there's no escape. Don't expect help from the people who've escaped the classroom, the higher-ups. They're busy going to lunch and thinking higher thoughts. It's you and the kids. So there's the bell. See you later. Find what you love and do it. It was April and sunny outside, and I wondered how many Aprils I had left. How many sunny days. I was beginning to feel I had nothing left to say to the high school students of New York about writing or anything else. My voice began to trail away. I thought I wanted to be out in the world before I was out of the world. Who was I to talk about writing when I'd never written a book, never mind publish one? All my talk, all my scribbling in notebooks amounted to nothing. And didn't they wonder about that? Didn't they say, how come he talks so much about writing when he never did it? It was time to retire, live on the teacher's pension that was less than princely. I'd catch up on the books I missed in the last 30 years. I'd spend hours at the 42nd Street Library, the place I love most in New York, walk the streets, have a beer at the Lion's Head, talk to DC, Duggan, Hamill, learn the guitar and 100 songs to go with it, take my daughter Maggie for dinner in the village, scribble in my notebooks, something might come. I'll get by. When Guy Lind was a sophomore, he brought an umbrella to school on a snowy, slushy day. He met a friend on the second floor who also had an umbrella. They began to fence with their umbrellas till the friend slipped and the tip of his umbrella pierced Guy's eye and left him paralyzed on one side. They took him to Beth Israel Hospital across the street, and that started a long journey from city to city and country to country. They even took him to Israel, where the fighting keeps them up to date in trauma and treatment. Guy returned to school in a wheelchair and wearing a black eye patch. After a while, he made his way through the corridors with the help of a walking stick. Eventually, he discarded the stick, and you wouldn't know of his accident except for the black eye patch and an arm that lay useless on the desk. Here was Guy, in my last class, listening to Rachel Blaustein on the other side of the room. She was talking about a poetry class she took with Mrs. Casella. She enjoyed the class, and the way Mrs. Casella taught poetry, but it was really a waste of time for her. What was there to write about when everything in her life was perfect? Her parents, happy and successful. Rachel, the only child, and headed for Harvard. Rachel, with perfect health. I told her she could add beauty to her catalogue of perfection. She smiled, but the question remained, what was there to write about? Someone said, I wish I had your troubles, Rachel. She smiled again. Guy told of his experiences in the past 2 years. For all he went through, he wouldn't want to change anything. In hospital after hospital, he met people shattered, sick, suffering in silence. He said all this put his accident in a different perspective. It took him out of himself. No, he wouldn't change a thing. This is their last high school class and mine. There are tears and expressions of wonder that Guy is sending us on our way with a story that reminds us to count our blessings. The bell rings and they sprinkle me with confetti. I'm told to have a good life. I wish them the same. I walk, color-speckled, along the hallway. Someone calls, Hey, Mr. McCourt, you should write a book. I'll try.
Teacher Man, a memoir, was written and read by Frank McCourt. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub, with editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producer was Sarah Ginsburg. Teacher Man was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.